Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In his painstakingly researched and splendid new book, Sculpting the Self, Muhammad Farooq charts and examines the multiplicity of ways in which the self and its moral flourishing have been discussed, debated, and examined in the Muslim intellectual tradition. The remarkable aspect of this book, though, is that he does so in close and extensive conversation with understandings of the self in Western philosophy, Indic thought, and even neuroscience. Philosophically dense, but yet eminently accessible, this book is a landmark publication in the field of Islamic studies and the study of religion more broadly. Here now is my conversation with Professor Muhammad Farooq. Hello, Muhammad. Welcome to the New Books Network. It is a pleasure to have you on our show. And congratulations on producing this really one-of-a-kind volume, I would say. It is an incredible exercise of philosophical density, which brings together a number of different thinkers and traditions. It's the kind of book that that will leave you a bit intellectually enriched and quite overwhelmed because of its brilliance. So great to have you on the show. We have a tradition on the New Books Network, Muhammad, that our first question is always biographical. I was wondering if you could briefly share with our listeners a bit something about your journey, how you became a scholar of Islam.
Sure. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me here. And thank you so much also for these very kind words about my humble book. And also, I want to also thank you, congratulate you on your book, which also received a prestigious award. So thanks for that as well. I personally learned from your book as well and your research in general. And yes, I'm looking forward to having also a great conversation. And talking about my own journey to Islamic studies, it's not the typical, I suppose, because when I was studying, I was an undergraduate student. So I was in London, I was studying economics at the University of London. And at that time, about, 12, 13 years ago, I never thought I would end up in academia, actually write a book on Islam and selfhood and all of this, because I had other plans and other radically different career plans, to put in a simple word. And actually, my father is a professor. He's a professor of mathematics. But for some reason, I always felt like teaching and this kind of career is kind of boring and so forth. But, you know, that's how life is. And I'm actually very glad that I kind of made that very audacious career change, I would say. When I was studying economics, and I was studying especially, I was interested in stock markets and all of these things, especially it was because in 2008, as you know, there was this great financial crisis that took place. And everyone was worried, everyone was beginning to question, you know, all of these different economic models that kind of failed to predict, you know, what was going on. So as I was studying all this, thinking about all this, and also thinking about the big picture, I was just wondering at one point whether when we have all, when we kind of, when we come up with all of these different quantitative econometric or just simply economic models, whether we can simply kind of talk about them without taking into consideration some conception of human subjectivity, because whatever happens in the external world, including the economic sphere, it's ultimately the actions of human actors. But these quantitative models usually would ignore anything that smack of qualitative factors, although there are sometimes some exceptions, like Robert Shiller, who is the one exception, the Yale trained economist, who did talk about psychological factors. Anyway, as I was kind of deeply thinking about the idea of human subjectivity being the kind of decisive factor in all of this, I felt like, you know, there's something deeply unsatisfactory with the paradigm itself, the overall arching focus on, you know, quantity and so forth. And I felt like, you know, when you have a degree on one of these subjects, economics or even physics, you know, the so-called queen of the sciences these days, you actually end up with a kind of rather narrow vision of the world at the end of the day. So I just felt like I need to explore humanities, I need to explore religion, philosophy, culture, and also from a different perspective, because I went to an English school and I completed my O-levels, A-levels, and I learned a great deal about a little bit about Western history and so forth. But I felt like, you know, one needs to kind of look at these things, look at the world, maybe from other cultural perspectives. So I thought I'd go to Iran, actually go for like with no intention of coming back in a way, like maybe settle in Iran, something like that. I would learn Arabic, Persian. I knew some Arabic, but kind of learn it so that, you know, I'm able to explore the Islamic intellectual tradition in depth, etc. So eventually after my degree, I did end up in Iran. I spent 3 years completing eventually a master's degree in Islamic philosophy and mysticism, studying in philosophical mysticism, Islamic philosophy, theology, and various other Islamic sciences. And that's how, at one point, friends told me to also apply for a PhD in the States. And I applied for a PhD at Berkeley and came to Berkeley and eventually wrote my dissertation on selfhood and subject formation in Islamic thought.
Wonderful. Well, I think that introduction will be very useful for listeners as they explore the book, both in our conversation and also in terms of reading the book itself. I thought perhaps we can begin the book. The theme is, of course, the question of self and selfhood, which is a really massive theme, but you interrogate it in a very capacious and extensive fashion. I thought perhaps in the beginning I could ask you about a category or a sort of, one might call it a conceptual sort of orientation that guides you throughout this book, what you call, very intriguingly, you called the spectrum theory of selfhood. Tell our listeners what you mean by that, the spectrum theory of selfhood, and why this category is useful to you in terms of the kind of argument you make about selfhood in this book.
Right. Yeah, I think that's definitely the central question in the book. So if you think about simply the word self, you'd perhaps agree with me that it's perhaps the most commonly used word in English language. I mean, every day, in our everyday conversations, everyone from whatever background they might come from, they would, at some point in different points in time, they would use the word self. And yet, when you think about what it means philosophically and kind of in a scholarly way, you look at different definitions and conceptions provided by different philosophers, you see kind of all, you know, like all kinds of disagreements to the point that there are philosophers, as you know, like Nietzsche, and then more recent philosophers like Daniel Dennett, Anthony Kenny, and even Hume, they would say that it's a kind of mistake to even posit something like a self. There is no self. They would kind of deny that. Is a self. On the other hand, there are other philosophers, of course, and psychologists like William James, Carl Jung, and more recently Galen Strawson, or phenomenologists such as Zahabi. They would say that, you know, there is of course a self otherwise, and nothing would make sense. Every conversation presupposes a self and something. So I thought of giving this elephant analogy, like it's, why is it that, you know, when it comes to different philosophers and also when it comes to different disciplines, you look at what people mean by self and you see like it's like almost they're talking past one another. And it's almost like it's, you know, the like blind man in that famous, you know, analogy of, you know, blind man trying to figure out what is an elephant, and they touch different parts of the body. And then when they're asked, what did you find out? They say, oh, you know, it's a side or it's a tusk, you know, different parts of the elephant. And they think that's the elephant, but that's not the elephant in itself or its totality. So something similar is happening with the self as well, even though it's such a central category in almost all disciplines, all the way from neuroscience to psychology to anthropology to religious studies. Selfhood, subjectivity, you see this, and Islamic studies is no exception. And yet, when you are just at the level of definition, you see that there are all kinds of disagreements. People, some saying there's no self, some yes, but again, you know, there's no kind of common overlap. So you end up thinking whether, you know, it's at all a meaningful category. So after studying, when I have realized all that, especially when it comes to, let's say, Islamic studies, which is my area of specialization, I'm sure you notice the word self everywhere, and people think this is a kind of simple translation of the term nafs, or sometimes khud in Persian, but there are lots of other terms. And they don't for a second question that whether it's not just a question of just one-to-one translate correspondence in terms of translation. Nafs does translate into self, but it can mean a lot of other things and there can be a lot of other words. So anyway, I was confronted with this methodological issue that, you know, there's a bewildering variety of terms in various Islamic languages, Arabic, Persian, Urdu, and other languages. And they all seem to be talking about what we would call selfhood or subjectivity today. And again, people think selfhood might mean just one thing. And that's, again, a kind of common misconception. And it never meant just one thing, nor in our time, nor in pre-modern times. So I thought, you know, there has to be a kind of this foundational study to overcome this methodological barrier. And I found that, you know, once I've kind of gone through the source texts themselves, I realized it's a matter of finding, I mean, after a lot of philological trial and error stuff, I eventually came to the conclusion that you have to find common connotations of various Islamic terms like nafs, that, ananiya, sometimes even nafs, natiqa, and all of these terms, and see whether they have a kind of common connotations which can be framed in terms of a spectrum. And I used the analogy from physics, you know, different kinds of spectrum, continuous, discontinuous, etc. But if you think of it as something like a spectrum, then you're not worried too much. There are some technical details, perhaps I shouldn't go through here, go into them right now. But if you think of it as a spectrum concept, then one, the problem that we face with respect to the word self, like there are all these contradictory conceptions sometimes, can be perhaps overcome. And that's what I try to do. I make a distinction between kind of descriptive versus normative conceptions. And most people don't even see that. And that's part of the problem. And the other problem is that they don't see that it's a multidimensional concept. And that is actually directly from the source texts themselves. When you read Avicenna, Mullah Sadra, Shah Wali Ullah, and many other people, they actually talk about the self in terms of being in terms of a multidimensional entity. So, you know, this descriptive and normative dimensions further divide into biophysiological, in my own model, sociocultural and cognito experiential, and then ethico spiritual, and so on and so forth. And I found it a very useful category of analysis to talk about the self in an all comprehensive manner, because it does seem to be the central focus in many of these philosophers and Sufi philosophers. And perhaps other people also. So that was very helpful. But there are also other kind of global perspectives involved, I would say. So maybe I can just briefly mention them. So when now beyond the kind of Islamic studies and methodological issues that we face and so forth, there are also issues with how we understand the self today, because it's intimately related to the question of human flourishing, meaning in life, spirituality, etc. Now, since the Enlightenment, and there is that, you know, there's this kind of Eurocentrism that's kind of all over, as we kind of observe again and again, and people tend to define everything, including the self, in terms of the values of science. And there's also a kind of reductionism that's in place. You know, people often would kind of locate, you know, human nature simply inside the self nucleus, and because it, as if it's kind of, it can be reduced to, you know, biological entity, biological mechanisms, etc. While forgetting that when it comes to our, you know, labor, social role, and moral and spiritual values, it cannot simply be kind of explained if we just kind of try to explain self through kind of reductionist, various reductionist paradigms and so forth. So I felt like there is something that one can contribute from coming from the, grounding oneself in the Islamic tradition, but at the same time, drawing on various other traditions, because Islamic tradition itself is, it's not a kind of, as you know, like it draws, historically drew from Greek, Indian, Persian tradition, and so forth. So there's this. So I also had the intention of kind of overcoming Eurocentrism, and I feel like in our kind of globalized world, I would say global post-Enlightenment world, I personally feel like we need to embrace a kind of what I call epistemic pluralism. Like we have to recognize that fundamental questions of philosophy, including selfhood, have been addressed by major cultures, and that there are multiple valid paradigms, epistemological frameworks to address the questions of truth, knowledge, and being. So yeah, so there are kind of several, you know, aims at work, and I felt like spectrum theory kind of helps me to address all of this.
Terrific. You know, the major strength of this book is the kind of really complex and detailed readings that it conducts of so many different Western, not only Western and Muslim, in fact, but you even go into Indic traditions, etc. I'll come to that in a moment. But maybe for the benefit of our listeners, to sort of for them to try to understand some key categories in this book, when I was thinking about this interview and, you know, what kinds of questions I might ask you, I sort of thought maybe it might be useful for our listeners if I have you talk about, if I ask you about some broad categories and then have you go in the direction that you would most like to go. So two other categories that are central to this book is, which comes up in the next chapter of the book, what you call the paradox of self-knowledge. And you propose, and then you sort of describe, or, you know, one category that is central in terms of the kind of resolution you offer to this paradox of self-knowledge, what you call non-reflective self-knowledge. I was wondering if you could explain these two categories, the paradox of self-knowledge, non-reflective self-knowledge, and how do the two relate to each other, and how is it connected to the way you address this paradox?
Right. So, I mean, these are very technical kind of discussions, as you can see. So I'll try my best and not to kind of meander into lots of details and too much technicality, but I'll try my best to kind of explain in kind of simple terms. So talking about the paradox of self-knowledge first, why do I think that there is a paradox involved? And so I'm trying to ask the question here. So we're talking about the self, but one basic epistemological question is, how does the self know itself? How do we know it ourselves, let's say, kind of putting it in first person terms. So I formulated this paradox, which if I try to explain it, it would be like the following. So on the one hand, for example, the self must be known prior to everything else, since anything that we know, it presupposes a self for which it's known. We always say, I know this, I see this, or any cognitive X, that part is clear. So that's, you know, that's on the one hand, that's there. But on the other hand, for something to be known, it must be an object, which then leads to a paradox. And while everything is known through the self, the self itself remains forever unknown because the self or the subject can never be an object. So if you think about any act of cognition, it always involves two poles, the subject pole and the object pole. They have to be separate. If not, then it doesn't make sense to say, I know this, even I know myself, or I know a tree, I'm kind of listening to this. None of these things would make sense. There's the subject pole, the object pole, and the act of cognition that connects the two. While this model works, when it can see everything else outside of us, like, the, you know, when I say I know the tree, yes, and I know it as an object. But when I say I know myself, there's a paradox, because the subject has to be a subject. And if the subject is, it cannot be subject and the object at the same time. And that's the problem. And it's a very subtle point. And I feel like lots of philosophers, including modern and non-modern, they kind of don't see it. But there are others, they see it. So to explain it perhaps a bit more, when I'm talking about this kind of act of cognition and subject pole and object pole, so in the act of cognition, when it comes to the knowing subject, you could say that this knowing subject stands for what I call the performative I, which is established by its epistemic authority to kind of act and or attend rather than kind of be acted or be attended upon. So you can also say that this state of the performative I is also it's also what can be called pure first-person subjectivity, since nothing other than the I can kind of participate in the realm of its epistemic acts. So every time I say I know myself, or I know myself, there is already that separation between the I as a subject and the kind of myself as an object, as an it. So in the case of external object, it's easy to see. I know tree, I know this tree, for example, and the tree can be, tree is the object and it's the it as opposed to the I. But something similar is also at work when we're trying to kind of reflectively know ourselves or make these statements based on reflections, like turning our gaze over ourselves. So every time we do that, we actually objectify ourselves. And this objectivized image of the self is actually an it in relation to the pure subject. And so when we don't see that distinction, of course, we don't notice it. But once we are aware that there is that distinction between I and it, like even my own image of myself, my own I can be an it in relation to my I, which is a subject. So once you see that there is an I and it distinction, then the subject can never know itself, it seems, according to this paradox, because every time we try to do it, we try to do it either reflectively or through introspection. So maybe this is still abstract. Let me just try to explain this through one example. So we're trying to kind of introspectively perhaps know ourselves. And so what happens? So the first thing you might say is when I attend to myself, I'm kind of performing this act of introspection on myself. But this, as I said, this already implies an objectivation of the self, which can be called the introspected self. And I'm kind of looking at myself, thinking, I'm kind of introspecting myself, my own self. So this introspected self can be kind of represented by, let's say, this Greek letter called theta. And you might say the self, which is doing the introspection, the real self, can be represented by some other letter, let's say it's phi. So the phi and the theta, they are actually different, because I'm able to kind of at least mentally posit the split between my introspected self and my introspecting self. Now, in order to have self-knowledge, there must be a kind of complete identity between phi and theta. But how can one ascertain this identity? That's where the problem arises. If I try to ascertain it through a further introspection, then I'll have kind of theta 1, and then the challenge would be to affirm the identity between theta 1 and phi and theta. But then, to affirm that identity, I'll need to carry out yet another act of further actor introspection and, you know, and so on and so forth ad infinitum. So I argue that the only way you can avoid the infinite regress here is by asserting that we somehow know ourselves in an a priori, non-objectifying fashion. So we have kind of immediate self-knowledge because the nature of the self and the consciousness at its most basic level are somehow united. There is no separation. As soon as we try to kind of know it through reflection, introspection, we fail to ascertain it because we kind of lapse into the subject-object dichotomy. So that's where this category of non-objective, non-reflective knowledge comes in. So it's very technical. So let's say, you know, it's easy to understand when you say we human beings possess reflexivity. We all have self-consciousness. We can turn our gaze on ourselves. That part is clear. But imagine there are those moments which people would call self-absorbed moments or dream moments when moments like dreamless sleep or states of intoxication, these kind of states, where you are not reflectively kind of aware that you are experiencing something, as in a state of dreamless sleep, or when you're too focused watching something and there are moments you actually are not aware that you're watching something. It's only when there's a lapse in the attention you come back. So those moments are actually moments when you are not completely absent from yourself. Your consciousness is there in the background. That's why you're able to remember what you are watching, for example, if it's a movie that you are watching, or even in a state of intoxication, a state of coma, there is some kind of background awareness. So I argue that, you know, those moments clearly show that it's not just through reflection that we come to know ourselves or through introspection. There's another a priori, more fundamental way of knowing ourselves, and that's the non-reflective way of knowing ourselves, what I call non-reflective self-knowledge. And it's laden with all kinds of implications.
Terrific. That was wonderful. The next chapter, you talk about this idea of the humane challenge from David Hume, of course. Humane challenge, I guess.
Yes.
So, could you explain to our listeners what this challenge entails? What does it mean? And again, you talk about a way to sort of address this challenge, or I guess meet or resolve this challenge. What you call the unity of self and consciousness. So I guess a three-part question. What is this challenge? What are some of its limitations? And how does this unity of self and consciousness help us overcome or meet this particular challenge?
Right. So again, it's a very interesting question. Hume is, of course, engaging Locke and Descartes and other philosophers who were his contemporaries or came before him. So the Humean challenge, in brief, is the idea that what we call self as a substance or even as an entity, it's an illusion. There is no self. It's rather, you know, always a question of the bundle of perceptions that kind of one experiences whenever one kind of tries to kind of discover the self or think about the self. So it's what we call self is actually a constant stream of fluctuating experiences. So he famously says, I'm taking an intimate look at myself, and then what all I see are all these fluctuating experiences, you know, sometimes love, sometimes hate, sometimes I feel hot, sometimes I feel light, this and that. So I don't see any self and so forth. So where is this self that people are talking about? There is no self. But Hume does not notice that the moment he makes this statement that when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, he's already kind of objectifying himself. What I was talking about before, like there is that distinction between I as pure subjectivity and something that is subject and that is attending as opposed to being attended or acting as opposed to being acted. So he's already kind of falling prey to the I-it distinction that, you know, I just mentioned earlier. So when he says, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, this myself is already an it in relation to the kind of pure I, the subject itself. He's already object. So he's not seeing that. So the whole problem comes down to, it boils down to the idea of kind of, we're, you know, he's trying to the self is the subject. It has to be the subject, as I said earlier. But he's trying to look for the self as an object, and it would inevitably result in a failure because, you know, it was not to be found. How can you find it? Because it's always the subject. So, I mean, there are lots of, I kind of attack it in the book from lots of different angles, but something perhaps I can mention. So if there is no self to begin with, how is it that he is able to report to us in a selfless way? Like if there was no underlying subject when he was making that claim, how is it that he's even able to report to the world that there is no self? In other words, how could he have reported his data, his argument in a kind of quote unquote selfless way? Because the moment you make any such a statement already presupposes an underlying subject that experiences all of these fluctuations, perceptions, and so forth. So Hume, I mean, perhaps he did feel like his argument was not fully sound. So there are statements at the end of the treatise, at the appendix, where he does seem to kind of intimate that maybe there's something more to what he was arguing earlier. But regardless, his arguments here that, you know, there is no self and it's always a kind of fluctuating stream, it's kind of self-contradictory. And so that's the Humean challenge. And you can easily resolve it if you accept that, you know, it's not what through reflective self-knowledge that we can have knowledge of ourselves. There's also a non-reflective way that's even more foundational, that actually grounds both ourself and consciousness. And at the level of non-reflective self-knowledge, there's actually no distinction between self and consciousness. The distinction and all of these things come into the view when we kind of try to reflectively know ourselves, when we use introspection and those kind of features or our consciousness. Notice that many people think the self only exists whenever kind of we start thinking, we start kind of doing philosophizing and so forth. But there is already a kind of our consciousness before we even started the process of thinking. What happens with the thinking is that, you know, it allows us to kind of see other objects outside of us or even in our own mind and image ourselves and kind of make a comparison, posit subject object. But I mean, that does not mean that before we started this process of philosophizing, there was no self, there was no I, there was no conscious. Of course there was. It's not like just switching on and switching off. Otherwise, you know, this phenomena that I mentioned earlier, the dreamless sleep, state of coma, and all of these other phenomena where there is consciousness, but there is no kind of reflective awareness of our own conscious being as kind of self-aware, as being self-aware. So, yeah, so I feel like, you know, when you have this category of non-reflective self-knowledge, you are able to address and overcome the Humean challenge and able to kind of show its limitations. Yeah.
Now, one of the features of this book, which is one of the most remarkable features of this book, which really makes it a towering book, but also, I'm sure it must have been a very difficult thing to do, is that, you know, although this book is, of course, firmly situated in Islamic studies, goes between the early modern and the pre-modern periods, but this book actively engages and discusses many Western philosophers, like you were just talking about David Hume and Kant, of course, has a major role. But then you also go into Indic thinkers. And then you also go into, not in some kind of passing fashion, but really in detail. I mean, I've read this book so very recently, so in detail to do with neurobiology, etc. Yeah. So I actually want to take a step back and just ask you, I mean, we don't have the time to go into each and every aspect here. Readers should do that. I would highly recommend that. But how did you decide this conceptual kind of decision of putting scholars and thinkers and traditions seemingly so sort of operating in such different universes into conversation with each other? And, you know, what benefit does it give you to do this? And what were some of the challenges that you faced as an author, as a researcher in this kind of an exercise?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. And let me try to answer it in some fashion. Yeah. So I would say that, it was challenging. I needed to spend a lot of time studying neuroscience, working with, thankfully, there was a good neuroscientist friend of mine, colleague at Berkeley, David Presty. But because I had this background in science, because my undergraduate was in economics, we studied mostly math, and just an intense interest in science right from the beginning, it didn't feel like I was kind of, to use C.P. Snow's famous phrase, two cultures or something, you know, the book that he wrote about science, the kind of divide that you see between science and philosophy and like science and humanities and so forth. So I never felt that personally. So as an author, it was always interesting. And then I realized that initially it might have felt like, when you're talking about neurobiological theories of consciousness and self or neuroscience of consciousness, this might be completely different. But there is a substantial overlap. If you already think of the self as being a multidimensional entity, having all of these distinct dimensions, including the biophysiological, and you already see it in someone like Mulla Sadra and Plato and others. So, and Shah Waliullah too, they were also, when they were talking about the self, there's a lot of scientific medical knowledge from which they're drawing, and as I discussed extensively. This is a vast tradition, stretching all the way back to Galen and before Galen, and then mediated through Islamic medical tradition, and then these mystical thinkers, philosophers kind of felt like they're able to kind of benefit from this pure, quote unquote, pure scientific knowledge, because of course, this conception of science as being a distinct category did not even exist at that time. But from our perspective, from our kind of contemporary perspective, it's easy to see that when you read books on the self or philosophy or the so-called philosophy of mind, in analytic philosophy, philosophers these days mostly rely on the scientific findings on everything. There is a kind of deeply entrenched naturalism and reductionism that is at work whether it comes to epistemology in general or it comes to topics in philosophy of mind, including self and consciousness. And so you feel like you have to know, because you read these philosophers, they themselves are influenced by this kind of scientific understandings, findings on the self and consciousness. And then you are curious, and then you read the books written by these neuroscientists, and they're making all of these extravagant, you know, claims about self and consciousness, saying, Christoph Koch saying, in the last 2,000 years, there was no progress on these topics. So finally, it's time to kind of, you know, recover, just wrench these topics, to use that kind of term, from philosophers and really kind of make it clear to the public what does consciousness mean and what does self mean and so forth, because philosophers have simply failed to kind of provide a satisfactory answer. So as you know, this is the kind of, it's part of the naturalizing tendency, you know, that you see, like topics that were previously part of philosophy or humanities now are being, like, you know, there is a whole bunch of sub-disciplines within neuroscience called neurotheology, neuroliterature criticism, and so forth, as if, you know, this kind of scientific experiments and just new, some of these new findings in neuroscience or neurophysiology can solve problems or can help us understand Shakespeare or Mulla Sadra, even, you know, all of these great philosophers in some magical fashion, or at least make, you know, can be very important. So I don't deny that they're not important. So that's the part. I do feel like the biophysiological part and the fact that people working in the neuroscience are now becoming more and more interested in these topics, it's actually a very good step. You know, there's a great deal to be learned from them when they talk about the self-brain relation and so forth. But there are also some notable kind of philosophical pitfalls and shortcomings that these neuroscientists, they unfortunately are not kind of, don't see, most of them at least. First of all, neuroscience of consciousness does not consider what we call first-person subjectivity. There's, because of this overwhelming emphasis on objectivism, like trying to know everything as an object and so forth, as is the case when it comes to kind of science in general, people think the self and consciousness can similarly be objectivized and kind of known, just like we know other objects and so forth. So I say that, you know, when it comes to Hume, you know, there's a problem because he's trying to know the subject, the self, as an object, and he's never able to. He's never successful. But when it comes to these neuroscientist people, they're not only objectivizing the self once, they're objectivizing it twice. First, when they're thinking it's an objective scientific investigation, and second, when they're making an effort to know the self through, you know, NCC, you know, neural correlates of consciousness and various other techniques and so forth. What they end up knowing are various states of consciousness, because consciousness is always the subject. There's no way one can step outside of one's subjectivity and kind of then objectivize all of one's thoughts, imaginations, memories, and so forth. Science itself presupposes, or all of these experiments, so obvious in a way, presupposes that we are all conscious in the first place, and that other people are also similarly conscious. It's an intersubject, it's a community of consciousnesses. We're all able to kind of understand each other. We presuppose all that, and then we come to all of these experiments and design complex set of experiments, etc. So again, unfortunately, apart from a few people like Francis Varela and people, neuroscientists who are actually working with some philosophers to kind of understand consciousness, self, in a deeper way, most of these studies, they kind of provide us with a very reductionist paradigm, like kind of the self is ultimately an epiphenomena of brain and so forth. So, and they're never able to tell us anything about all of these complex, for example, features that we're able to uncover through kind of philosophical method. Like when I claim that there are different ways of knowing ourselves, reflective way and non-reflective way, and consciousness is multimodal, self is a multidimensional. How is it that neuroscientists are not able to tell us these facts about consciousness? They're able to tell us a great deal about what happens in the brain when, you know, our mind works, you know, performs a certain action, this and that. So I feel like, you know, when we engage these neuroscientists and these disciplines from both philosophical, again, people think, you know, modern, pre-modern is such a sharp divide. Pre-modern philosophers perhaps do not have anything kind of, you know, kind of mind-blowing important to say about them because these are supposedly modern topics. So I as you might have noticed, you know, the very first chapter asked that question of whether the self is a modern invention, because a lot of people to this day in various fields seem to think it is a modern invention, this idea of self-determination, inwardness, inner depths, and et cetera. Unfortunately, even people like Charles, you know, philosophers like Charles Taylor, they seem to think it's a modern invention, and so forth. So when, and then the, I mentioned already in the Enlightenment ideology and kind of Eurocentric biases. So when we are able to overcome all this, we are actually able to see that these are not like figuring out whether heliocentrism is true as opposed to geocentrism. Those are different matters. This is matters of self and consciousness. And all of these traditions, Buddhism, Hindu, in India, and various other Indian traditions, Advaita Vedanta, they have, you know, an amazing amount of profound reflections on these topics. And they're not going to, we cannot simply kind of turn a blind eye to these literatures by simply thinking, oh, those are kind of relics of the past and so forth. And because when you actually study these things, we realize how complex these materials are and how actually helpful they can be when it comes to some of the most complex issues related to self and consciousness today, the so-called hard problem of consciousness and so forth. So I felt that at the end, it was a very challenging task, but at the end of the day, I felt like it can be extremely rewarding, because there are, already we have this artificial divide between science and humanities, as we always experience in our universities. This is an unhealthy divide. There's a lot to kind of there's a great overlap, especially when it comes to these topics, and it only enriches our understanding. So, yeah.
Okay. So two of the major protagonists that are central to the concerns of this book, and really we ought to be talking about each one of them one by one, and we again, like the other thinkers and topics of the book, cannot do justice to the extensive detail and complexity with which you engage their thought. But they, of course, you've already mentioned them here, Mulla Sadra and Shah Waliullah. So I'm going to ask you what I would preface is a slightly unfair question, which is to give you the opportunity to discuss, because it's so extensive, the multiple things that you talk about in relation to them. But the reason I'm keeping it open-ended is to provide you with the sense of what you think are perhaps the most important take-home points for our listeners to take away from their work. So yeah, perhaps we can start with Mullah Sadr and then go to Shah Waliullah to keep the chronology in place. What aspects of their thought were particularly crucial to you and that you examine in this particular book in terms of theorizing the self?
Right. So it's an intense theoretical kind of theorizing exercise, as you can see. And I would categorize this kind of works as reflective and constructive. But while engaging lots of historical sources, doing the kind of required philological work as well. So I try to kind of balance all that, but I'm kind of also trying to address a modern audience, a philosophical audience outside of Islamic studies and potentially scientists themselves who are interested increasingly, I mean, the vast amount of literature that you have on neuroscience of consciousness, testifies to this. So I had to come up with kind of suitable vocabulary set of technical terms like, non-reflective self-knowledge and this and that, which would at the same time accurately portray some of the core arguments of this traditional non-modern Islamic philosophers such as Mullah Sadr. So it's a kind of multi-layered exercise, but I felt like these terms accurately reflect. And again, it's not a kind of simple translation of what explanation of what Mullah Sadr or Shah Waliullah are saying, and then kind of conveying that to a modern audience. It's rather engaging philosophically with this historical material, so as to propose a new theoretical paradigm about the self. So there are a couple of areas where I feel like they're saying things that would be extremely helpful, perhaps, to people interested in this topic. So we're talking about non-reflective self-knowledge, and again, I was trying to point out how, when it comes to various theories of self coming from, let's say, it's something like social anthropology, social constructionism, or sociology in general, or, from the other end, like physicalistic theories. These kind of ideas, like non-reflective knowledge, would help us to see that there is more to these things than meets the eye in the beginning. So this, but then it does not end there. I feel like when it comes to both Mullah Sadr and Shah Waliullah, it's not simply the epistemological questions of self-knowledge and how do we know ourselves. It's rather the deep and intertwining relationship between self-knowledge and ethical cultivation. And that's where you can see how in the model that I provided, the spectrum theory, descriptive and normative can be so helpful. Because normative dimensions kind of bring together the ethical and spiritual dimension, while the descriptive deal with more philosophical and scientific dimensions of selfhood. But oftentimes you have people only overly focusing on, let's say, just the descriptive dimension of the self or the normative dimension, especially, let's say, in the philosophical tradition, especially after Descartes, philosophers do not even think that there can be kind of profound nexus between non-reflective self-knowledge and self-cultivation. So, it should be kind of so obvious to people studying Plato and people studying, just random Yogacara philosopher and so forth. But to us, it seems like after Descartes, all when it comes to kind of having kind of self-knowledge, it seems like all you need is a kind of functioning rational mind. And then you kind of sit by your fire and meditate, and lo and behold, you come to realize that you're res cogitans, as opposed to thinking thing alone, as opposed to res extensa, the extended thing. And then you're thinking how you relate to the external world, mind and the world, and all of these topics and so forth. So I actually agree here with Foucault. He was this, because I studied Descartes for years, but I agree. I kind of noticed this in Foucault as well, that, yeah, when it comes to ancient philosopher, you're reading Alcibiades, and it's so clear, let's say, one of the Platonic dialogues, which some people say was not attributed to, it's not Plato's, but nonetheless, I mean, this theme runs in other Platonic dialogues and other philosophers as well. But after Descartes, you know, this idea that self-knowledge is not simply limited to, let's say, in today's kind of broadly speaking analytic philosophy, one's dispositional properties or kind of standing attitudes or simply mental states like imaginations, thoughts, memories, and so forth, it's not at all clear. So today when people are talking about self-knowledge, they're thinking, you know, it's about our mental states, it's about our standing attitudes, and et cetera, et cetera. But there's also what some other scholars say, Socratic self-knowledge. And I kind of boil down all of these categories into what I call at that point reflexive versus Socratic self-knowledge. So when it comes to a thinker like Mulla Sadra, it's absolutely important that we see when we think of self-knowledge and we're thinking of ethical cultivation at the same time, because without these ethical cultivations, there is no guarantee that one is able to know oneself as one is. And it's so clear in the case of Descartes. He's thinking, where does he get the idea that we are just a thinking thing? That's not philosophers, and I mean, it can be a philosophical argument, but you can see, like, after Descartes, Locke, basically agreed, Hume tried to find problem. Kant also, of course, tried to refute that, and we're still struggling with that. But it's just a subjective definition that we are just a thinking thing and that we are substance. These are the categories that actually limit who we truly are. For someone like Mulla Sadra or for someone like Shah Waliullah, it's a very complex process, the way we come to know ourselves and the way we kind of think of ourselves as a self. It's a multidimensional entity, and there are layers of kind of knowing and so forth. And at each stage, various spiritual exercises, such as meditation and this and that, they help us to kind of uncover a different layer of ourselves. And at the end of the day, it's indefinable. You know, of course, you would say, you know, people in Islamic philosophers in the Islamic tradition, they kind of use the term rational animal. From Aristotle to define the self, but that's only the most rudimentary definition of the self. Ultimately, the self cannot be defined, and paradoxically, it brings us back, you know, closer to kind of some of these postmodern traditions, you might say. But ultimately, yes, it's, you know, who we are. It's a deep question that cannot be simply answered through just one philosophical argument or some kind of definitions, as with Descartes and so forth. So I feel like these are very important, because sometimes when you have a fixed definition of who you are, or you can also ask whether that definition is different for men and women and those kind of questions, then it limits ourselves. So at the end of the day, in this book, I'm concerned with all the question of human flourishing, meaning in life, which, you know, we're all concerned with. And, you know, sometimes that kind of deterministic ideas of who you are can be obstacles to kind of flourish, expand, and know the full extent of our possibility, where I discuss the notion of the perfect human and self-perfection in both Mulla Sadra and others. But I feel like these are some of the areas where Mulla Sadra kind of can be so important. And as for Waliullah, he also more or less agrees when it comes to how we know ourselves. He accepts that there are different ways of knowing ourselves. And he also agrees with the idea of non-reflective self-knowledge. But in addition to all that, there are some distinct contributions that Shah Waliullah himself makes. And so I kind of argued how when he was talking about self in relation to the subtle fields of consciousness, or lataif and pneuma, nasama is the Arabic word, he is able to kind of bring together, synthesize elements from Stoicism, or Galenism, and then kind of and the Islamic medical tradition, Sufi traditions, and also bits and pieces from various traditions of Islamic philosophy. In doing so, you can see different currents of thoughts in Shah Waliullah's conception of the self, which is again very complex. But at the same time, there are some notable innovations. Mm-hmm. So, for example, for Shah Waliullah, unlike Stoicism or Galenism, the self, being immaterial and the most subtle of all the forms, cannot but be dependent on a body, which is also the most subtle of all the bodies, maturing at the finest degree of subtlety and equilibrium. And he calls this subtle body pneuma, that's what I was referring to earlier, which is the kind of intermediary between the self, which is immaterial, and the body, which is kind of material. So it's a very complex synthesis of you can say Aristotelianism and Galenism. It's not purely materialistic. It's still talking about the self in terms of, you know, form and matter, you know, hylomorphism and so forth. But then this is not exactly the Aristotelian hylomorphism, because there is something in between, you know, the subtle body that's not there in Aristotle. And also the self being kind of immaterial, which is coming from, of course, new, you know, Platonic traditions mediated by Avicenna and others. So these are all kind of interesting elements, and they just also show how when it comes to the self, you know, there are kind of different theories. It's not just all Islamic philosophers, Sufis, they're just saying the same thing. Sometimes, because it's a spectrum, you can see some overlap here and there, but at other times, there are notable kind of differences and so forth. Just like in modern times, there are all kinds of theories of self, even between two, you know, I don't know how people would categorize, like Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus. I mean, both of them are, you know, people who say existentialist philosophers, yes, but, you know, Sartre has a very different, not very different. There are agreements in some places, but there are also differences between him and Camus, like, you know, the absurd that Camus proposes is not something that Sartre would agree with. So similarly, there is that spectrum when it comes to non-modern theories of self, and we need to recognize that and not think that, oh, this kind of non-modern, or people use the term pre-modern, I feel like that's already kind of derogatory. So these traditions have a lot to provide when it comes to the topic of the self, which is something, you know, like everywhere. So yeah, I would kind of stop there about this question, yeah.
Now let's come to the next key theme of the book, which actually is the title of the book. Usually when we talk about the title at the sort of beginning, but you have a very interesting structure in the book that you towards the end come to this key theme of the sculpting the self, which is a very interesting category. I was wondering if you could tell our listeners again what this means, sculpting the self, and how this exercise of, you know, sculpting the self. You make a very interesting point in the book, which I found very quite productive, is that although it is focused on the individual, but it need not be individualistic. I was wondering if you could also talk about that aspect as you describe this term, sculpting the self.
Right. Let me think. So I think I'll begin by trying to explain what do I mean by sculpting the self. Yes, so it comes from that distinction between descriptive and normative dimensions when talking about the self. So this, when it comes to selfhood, it's many people think, especially if someone is coming from a straightforward neuroscientific or just simply scientific perspective, oh, it's a kind of descriptive thing. You just describe what's going on. But while that one can do away with that kind of exercise when describing the structure of the leaf, for example, or some other object. But when it comes to self, you know, there is inevitably that normative dimension because of self-consciousness and because the way we're able to kind of turn back our gaze on ourselves. So I explain normativity in detail in some place, but the brief idea is that selfhood is something both kind of received and achieved. So people often talk, so I use also the term aspiration in to talk about the self. It's like, you know, sometimes it's like even when you think of the body, and sometimes people are simply not satisfied with their physical shape, whatever, and they think, you know, they just go to the gym and then kind of improve and exercise and get a better physical, you know, aesthetically pleasing shape or whatever. Something similar is at work with the self as well. Sometimes we take a look at ourselves, and we're not simply happy with all that we are doing, and we still feel like there's a lot we can do to kind of make something new of ourselves. So it's like when you're talking about the self, yes, there are kind of descriptions you can provide, how it relates to the brain or how the physical dimension kind of affects our mental events and so forth. But there's also this normative dimension where it's, to use some kind of this analogy, so kind of work in progress or seed, I think would help the reader to understand why I'm using the term sculpting the self. So if we think of the self not just like, not something like an electron, but something like a work in progress, like something like a seed, then we can see that, you know, it's it's a matter of achievement. It's a matter of what one can be or one what should be, how and or how one should sculpt oneself. So, or according to these philosophers, the self contains the seed of spiritual perfection that can be realized by the therapeutic use of various spiritual exercises. So toward the end, I talk a great deal about meditation and self-examination and other related spiritual practices and how they transform the self. So the whole idea is that, you know, when it comes to the default setting of the state of the self, the so-called ordinary condition, there's a lot that can be criticized. Or people can already see that, you know, that's not who they are. It's a question of who they should be and so forth. The should question brings normativity into the play already. So when, as we begin to think what we should be, we think of different paradigms. Like how then, you know, all right, this the criticism of the ordinary situation, then what is the transformation paradigm and what is the kind of result? And so to talk about these transformation paradigms, you know, I felt it's kind of, I would use that phrase, sculpting the self, taking my clue from Plotinus, of course, you know, that famous passage, I think Aeneid 4-5 or something, where he's asking us to be sculptors of ourselves and so forth. So that, I think it's a, yeah, I felt like that would be quite helpful, like how this therapeutic use of spiritual exercises can help us transform ourselves. So this is the key question here. It's not a question of describing the self or simply just throwing in some possible remedies, but it's the question of real offering some real programs for transformation that will lead to human flourishing, that would make life meaningful and so forth. So that's where this term and this idea is coming from. And also, as I said, so, I mean, this is, of course, it's kind of anthropocentric. It's focused on the individual. And these authors, they're always... It's very clear, you know, whom they're addressing. They're always addressing the individual. It's the you that you hear in Arabic, Persian most of the time. But at the same time, it's not the kind of liberal individualism which someone like Tocqueville aptly actually described once as, you know, individuals confined to their little circles. So it's not individuals confined to their little islands and circles and so forth. So actually, it's focused on individual. It's anthropocentric, but I use another term not frequently. Perhaps I should have the term anthropocosmic, because it's much more than the individual. As we know more and more of ourselves, we come to see how deeply interconnected we are with everything else. So I felt like maybe let me try to find one or two quotes from both Mulla Sadra and Shah Waliullah that just so clearly. Bring out this dimension of anthropocosmic idea of the self. So for example, Mulla Sadra at one point says, talking about this anthropocosmic dimension as opposed to just being individualistic, he says, quote, it belongs to human to know everything, and his self has the receptivity for every form, since there is nothing without an equivalent within him. So all existing entities are parts of his self, and despite his oneness, he is all things. وَحْدَتْهُ جَمِيعُ الْأَشْيَاءِ Because his self is a microcosm, his self is a macrocosm, his body is a microcosm. There's nothing in reality that is not under his subjection. End of quote. So it's also interesting, as opposed to other writers who always say the self is the microcosm, the world is the macrocosm, he actually inverts this image. But it clearly shows the kind of end result of this process and exercise. Similarly, in Shah Waliullah too, there's this sentence, passage where he says, quote, when the coarseness of earthly existence in the Gnostic, Arif, is replaced by the highest assembly, his identity, such as being the son of so-and-so and possessing a body of so-and-so, disappears. So it's really, at the end of the day, trying to say that this process of transformation should lead us to see that the profound interconnection between all things. And you can, I didn't talk about it, but it's actually related to my next project and the current ecological crisis and climate change and all of that. Because what happened, in the 17th century, scientific revolution and Cartesianism and divide between res cogitans and res extensive mind in the world, led to this unhealthy kind of alienation of the self from nature, and also the mechanistic worldview that simply, you know, posited the other, including nature, as simply, you know, machine-like, and to this day you can see it, you know, the excessive, you know, quantification of things can again testifies to this. So yeah, so it's clearly not individualistic when you see this. It's focused on the individual, but it's kind of trying, it's supposed to be anthropocosmic, encompassing everything else. That does not mean that I become everyone, someone simply becomes the entire universe ontologically. Of course, that's not the case. As Mulla Sadra was saying, it's the question of realizing the form of everything within one's being and receptivity, because the self has the receptivity for every form. And this self ultimately opens onto the divine and kind of opens onto the infinity in a way. So there is no kind of limit to what we can become, you know. And when you look at human beings globally, what people as a whole can do, what we have done, like the limit to no one has said there is a limit to our knowledge. Some people might get tired, but there are lots of people. They simply feel it's, you know, their physical age that makes them tired. They don't feel tired knowing things or having more curious even at age 90. And the amount of, you know, the variations and, you know, the gifts that people have and how they met. It's simply, you know, there is something I think remarkable to notice about human beings, like what we can do, what we can be, and so forth. But it's the question of actualizing what we potentially are. And so it's a very individual process. Like everyone, I used the paradigm of the perfect human, Al-Insan al-Kamil, and explained it in a way that would be more relevant here. But so everyone is a potential Insan al-Kamil, but it's a question of realizing the specific perfections that would actually be helpful in one's life in a given situation. And that's where these paradigms of transformation, this outlook can be helpful. And again, I also point out that there should never be just one paradigm. There are lots of other paradigms, like, you know, like yoga, like Chinese philosophies and so forth. And one should not think that there should be just one global conception of the self that would satisfy for once and for all the questions about, you know, meaning in life and human flourishing. I don't think that's what one should be doing, but nonetheless, there should be some paradigms so that depending on who is coming from where, people can still benefit from these paradigms. Yes.
So you've already touched on this a bit, Mohammed, but as we're coming to the end of our time, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about your next project, what you're thinking about as your next project.
Yes, so I think I should be very brief. But the current book that I'm working on is about whether or not Sufi philosophy and practice, especially as it's articulated in this Club Ibn Arabi, support and foster an active engagement toward the planet's well-being and also an ecologically viable way of life and vision. So I just started a course on religion and climate change last semester and also thinking of teaching it again next semester. So this is what I'm currently working on. And I feel like this topic of self-food is somewhere there, but it's more like the application of that. Yeah.
Sculpting the Self by Muhammad Farooq, published by the University of Michigan Press in 2021. Thank you so much, Muhammad, for your time, for writing this really incredibly dense but exciting book, and for sharing some aspects of it, some brief aspects of it with our listeners today and to be on the New Books Network. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me here.
This was my conversation with Professor Mohammed Farooq about his wonderful and brilliant new book, Sculpting the Self. I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. And I hope you will also join us next time for another fresh episode of NBIS. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.